Welcome to the Advance Your Art podcast, where we talk about the journey from artist to entrepreneur and everything in between. You've worked hard to hone your craft. Now take it to the next level with tips, techniques, strategies, and routines used by successful artists to grow their businesses and careers. Now, let's get started and have some fun with your host, Yuri Cataldo.
Hello, Jason. Welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
I'm great, Yuri. Thanks for having me on the show.
Of course. It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me. I'd like to start off by asking how you describe yourself and what it is that you do.
Well, I sort of hate the label, but I do think, sadly, like entrepreneur is probably the best label for me now. Mm-hmm. I used to tell people a much more complicated thing, like, well, I'm a bass player, I play bass, and I do this podcast, and I have a blog, and I do speaking events, I write a book, and I'm like, wait a minute, all those kind of like fall under one word. So I think that's pretty much another term is I'm like a double bass. That's my instrument. Double bass community organizer. That's another way to sort of look at what I'm doing in 2017 right now.
Okay. Wow. That's double bass community organizer. That is actually one of the most creative ways I've heard someone describe themselves. That's great.
So it's pretty much like what I spend the bulk of my day doing in some way, whether it's online or in person. So I think that's mm-hmm. kind of a nice, if I don't want the like sort of, you know, buzzwordy entrepreneurial kind of like label, community organizer sounds a little bit more timeless, maybe.
Yeah, it does. It does. And I think it opens up to a lot more possibilities.
Yeah.
So was there one important thing that you learned growing up from a parent or teacher or mentor that had an impact on your career today, whether it's in your music or community organizing career?
Yeah, like what growing up, what was lots of people for sure. I think that meeting. There's a famous bass player named François Rabaf, and he's a French bass player, had this fascinating background, he's originally from Syria, grew up in France, and it was interesting to me because I've always thought, like, what does François do exactly? Like, he was one of the first people I saw in my world that kind of made his living not playing in a professional orchestra or not teaching at a university. And he was putting out these books and just he revolutionized the bass world back in the 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. He's still active today, actually. He's performing. He's 85 years old and still performing. And he's somebody that I discovered him maybe when I was 15, 16 years old. And it was just like, mind blown, just like the creative things that he was doing and how he was like following his own path and how he's changing lives and influencing people in this very, very unique way. He was somebody that really changed the way I thought about bass music, what people do as a profession in this music world, everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm really curious then, why the bass? Like, was there something really early on that triggered that? What got you interested in playing the bass?
It's one of those things. A lot of people end up on the bass. If you start your child as a 5-year-old, bass is actually starting to become a thing some people do, but typically no. Typically it's piano, violin, and maybe cello or a handful of other instruments. Bass is something like, oh, I was doing this other thing and now I play bass. Or I was doing this, I was bored. The orchestra teacher said, hey, we need a bass player. Go play that thing. Mm-hmm. And that was my story. I started on violin and I really wanted to quit and my parents wouldn't let me. And I went to kind of a rough junior high school and I was worried I was going to get beaten up carrying this violin case around, which was a reasonable concern, actually. Mm-hmm. And actually some people, I ran into some of these long haired guys that said, hey, isn't that kind of like a bass? I'm like, kind of like a bass. And they said, well, we need a bass player for our band. You want to play bass? And so I proposed to my parents, can I play electric bass and not violin. They're like, well, you can play electric bass, but you have to still play an orchestra, so you can maybe move over. So I asked my orchestra director, started playing bass, mm-hmm. and then, I don't know, by the time I was 14, that was all I wanted to do. And that's with all the people I've interviewed in the bass world, that's a common story. It's very rare to find somebody that started when they were 5 or 6. In fact, a lot of people make that switch later. I interviewed mm-hmm. a guy named Klaus Freudenstein in Bavaria, who he was like a tax man for the German government. Until he was like 20, and then he moved over to the bass, and now he's a professional bass player. So it's a thing that people come to a lot of the time in their teens from something else.
Mm-hmm. So I don't consider myself a bass player, but I did play bass in a band.
Ah, nice.
In my high school days, very much like what you described. So I was playing piano and I was playing uh-huh. violin,
uh-huh.
and I had some friends that are like, hey, we're starting a band, but we need a bass player.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, okay, I'll do that. So I could be in a band. So I learned how to play the bass and bought an electric bass and did that for a few years. Our band was awful.
Uh-huh.
A lot what of was, off-key.
What was the name of your band? Do you remember?
I do. The band's name was Circadia.
All right.
Because of circadian rhythms, it was some kind of like the lead singer had a very intellectual way he would describe it in a very artsy kind of way, but that's ultimately what it came from. And though now I think there's another, I think it was Googling a few weeks ago, there's another band that like has taken over that name and is now doing much better than we ever did. So I'm glad that they are elevating that. But yeah, we played around, I'm from Indiana, we played around a lot of coffee shops, mostly to our friends, our angsty friends, drinking coffee, singing All the Feelings, and playing bass. So yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Good teenage experience and rite of passage. And I grew up in South Dakota. So I was like South Dakota teenage punk rock scene, which you think there wouldn't be much of that, but there are angsty people everywhere. And my band was called, our name was Toxic Death.
Wow.
Which then we changed it to Committed for like a slightly less aggressive stance, and
sure.
Then band drama ensued and the band broke up like so many do, and I then all of a sudden I got really weirdly into orchestra music, and I haven't really played in a band since early high school. It just moved over into the classical jazz kind of world, and that's where I've been ever since.
That's great. So when you transitioned to the new name of Committed, did your music stay the same, or did your band kind of mellow up a little bit along with the name?
I think had we released more than one indie album, we probably would have mellowed, but sadly it was like Toxic Death putting out our demo, you know, like printing the stuff at the copy shop and mm-hmm. like folding them into the cassettes and printing the labels, all that sort of stuff.
Oh my God, yes.
And as we were doing that, that was when we changed the name to Committed. I guess we just didn't want Toxic Death. Had a cool like logo drawn up for Committed, and then put those out. I think played one show and then broke up. So, but one of the guys in that band is still in South Dakota and is like still like organizing rock shows and that kind of thing. So it's kind of fun to see.
That's great.
One of them found their calling in that.
That's great. And transitioned further. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
So could you walk me through then your journey from your days in the band and your early musical days through university and then your early music career?
Sure. Yeah, I will be. I will not go on and on too long. I'll give you the bullet point version and we can dig in anywhere you want.
Okay, sure.
But yeah, I ended up falling in love with classical music and that sort of thing. Met a great bass teacher named Jeff Bradetage, one of the world's great bass teachers. Taught at Northwestern in Chicago.
Okay.
And I went to Chicago to study with him at Northwestern. Turns out his career was in transition at that point, and he had just accepted a job at the University of North Texas, which is actually the world's largest bass program. They've got something like 80 bass players at UNT.
Wow.
So I got there just as he was leaving, which made me sad, but I ended up studying with a great bass teacher in the Chicago Symphony at mm-hmm. Northwestern named Michael Hovnanian, who, interestingly, we've kept in contact and have worked together and remained friends ever since. I started blogging, I'm jumping ahead for a second, but I started blogging and he thought that was pretty cool and he started blogging and in just this really sort of punk rock cool way and ended up getting a lot of attention for his blog because he was just like a person in the Chicago Symphony that was writing whatever, like the perspective of somebody in a job like that. And it was so fun. And then we played in a bass quartet and so on and so forth. Great friend, and he's actually done a lot of really interesting stuff in the music world outside the Chicago Symphony. So Northwestern, and then I was planning, hoping, dreaming, whatever, to get a professional orchestra job, like so many people do, and like so many people do, that didn't happen. I got out of school, and I full of sleepless nights and anxiety, like how am I going to pay back all this crushing music student loan debt that I have accrued, and what am I going to do, and is the Starbucks counter in my future, or Borders, at the time was so many of my fellow music school grad student friends were like headed that direction. Nothing wrong with that, but I ended up landing a bunch of freelance orchestra gigs and started doing that and did that for about 7 years, did pretty well in that world. My wife, who I met in music school, was a harpist. She started freelancing harp, and she came home one day and she said, "That's it. I'm done with this harp freelance business." Because it's hard. It's hard to be a bass freelancer carrying your bass around, but that's nothing compared to harp.
I bet.
Yeah, harp is a beast. And you, if you ever see a harp at an event, like my wife would be dressed up like she's going to prom or something, and like this dress and all this makeup. But the harpists, they're having to load that harp in and out of loading docks and trying to avoid getting tickets for double parking and that sort of thing. And it's just a hard life. And she decided to go to medical school, which made me sort of think, do I want to go back to school? Because I'd always sort of like been on that fence, and I ended up going back to school and actually going into what was like my last resort career choice back in high school, which was music ed. I actually went back and got certified in Illinois, went and taught high school for a bunch of years. And that was right around the time when I started the blog and the podcast and all that. Okay. Like I thought, okay, I don't want to try to get an orchestra job anymore. I've taken 30 auditions and I'm doing okay sometimes, most of the time not, and I'm nearing 30, and I'm increasingly unwilling to do that. So is this my life? And then I see my wife say, I don't want this to be my life. I'm going to go this way. So that started getting me thinking. So I stopped practicing for all these orchestra auditions, which opened up a lot of time. And I, instead of spending 6 hours a day in the practice room, I thought, what am I going to do with all this time? I sort of like had a work routine built in. Like, even though I was a freelancer, I was pretty disciplined with my time. And instead of practicing these 12 excerpts for 4, 5, 6 hours a day, what am I going to do? And so I spent some time just like wandering around Chicago, like looking around, which is fun. And then I just started like thinking about my teaching studio. Is there something I can do with that? And I started blogging. I started like a student resource blog. And it was like the lesson summaries of all my students at the time. And it was like a page for parents to check out, which I think I still have somewhere on my blog, like from 2005. It's like the lesson summaries of all of my students up there. And I started putting more and more time into that blog. And this is about 2005, and started joining blog rings and started using Technorati and doing Technorati tagging and all these things that anybody who was active in the mid-2000s would know. And I started to get – and I installed a site meter on my site so I could see who's coming to my blog. And all of a sudden, I started to get traffic. I started to see, hey, wait a minute. I'm getting 50 people a day, 100 people a day, 200 people a day, 500 people a day, and the number just kept going up and up. And at that point, it was more than just a student resource blog. I was writing about the music world and writing about the bass and this and that. And I thought, and I started to tell a couple of crazy gig stories, like weird stuff, like one of your former guests, Justin Locke, like stories kind of like what he told.
Sure.
And I had a really good one that I was waiting, and I thought, maybe I should tell this story on my blog, but let's wait. And I forget what the metric was, but I thought I'm going to wait until I hit this number of people per day, and then I'm going to tell this story. Mm-hmm. And it was a story that about my car catching fire and exploding on the way home from Northwest Indiana, which is a thing that happened. And I told that story, and there's like my blog before I told that story and then after. And it just like went viral, essentially. And that I, like, long story short, like, I ended up getting profiled on all these things. Like, I remember the New Yorker linking to me, and I remember I was in like International Musician and a couple other publications, and that sort of like started this career trajectory that I'm actually on now. Mm-hmm. Later, but I kind of took a left turn, went into the world of public education, and I had a moment. Am I going to go this way or that way? And ended up the blog, it launched all the really interesting aspects of my career, and then I kind of put it on hold for a while, relaunched it, mm-hmm. and the podcast a couple years ago, and it kind of did what was happening in 06, 07. That sort of began to happen again, and that's kind of my career now.
Okay, great. Wow. Yeah. I'm curious then, with that, because you were in the, you know, in the blogging and podcasting kind of earlier on in the mid-2000s, how did you – were there books you were reading, or was it all forum-based? Like, how did you learn about well, I don't know. I mean, did you get into, like, SEO and keywords? And I know you mentioned a couple of those, but was that something that was more prevalent in the early 2000s and learning about that?
Sure. Yeah, it started to happen. It's kind of like I was – a podcast I love that if people that listen to your show don't listen to, mm-hmm. Fizzle.co, great podcast and great site and source. And I was listening to them recently. They were talking about the, laying down track and hoping that the train comes. And I had the problem of, like, I had this big train and I thought, oh, I got to lay down track. Like, I had built something that was popular, but I hadn't given any thought to it being like, okay, all these people come, now what, right? So it ended up turning into a business, but it was something that I kind of like went back and gave some thought to. So yeah, I did. Now I have my plugins and I'm looking for keywords that I'm writing, and I did start to do that in the mid-2000s, but it was okay. We're in a different space for that now than we were then, for sure.
Right. Okay. So then let's talk about your writing, because is this a recent thing where you kind of started more writing, and are you turning your blog into books, or is it, how does that work?
Yeah, I writing was kind of what I did. I still write, and I mm-hmm. still put things out on the blog. I kind of left the crazy gig story world because what I found is, like, those are fun and people like reading them. Right. There's really no business in that besides like writing a crazy gig book, which maybe I'll do at some point. But that's not what people ended up. And continue to come to my site for are like these meaty base posts that I write and wrote back in the day. I relaunched all this stuff in 2015, kind of knowing that my wife got a job in San Francisco. We're going to move. I have all this stuff I've built in Chicago. Do I want to try to rebuild this portfolio career that I have for myself in Chicago, in San Francisco, or do I want to try to do something else? And so I kind of made the decision to leave public education and dig into this stuff. So, okay. But I decided to focus on the podcast, actually. So the writing, it's probably like 5% of what I do now, and the podcast is my platform, more or less. Now, I have been putting out some writing, and I put out a book called Winning the Audition, but it's actually drawn from the podcasts. Okay. So I'm really focusing on the podcast these days, and that's the thing that's really been building the community and that kind of thing. And then the writing is sort of like an offshoot of that.
Okay.
That's kind of where I'm at with that right now.
Yeah. So with your podcast and your community, is there, like, have you developed like a Facebook group, or how do you get your community together and use that?
Yeah, and these days, yes, Facebook group is that has been huge. In fact, I could even see my Facebook group eventually becoming like the introduction to the podcast, rather than like you're listening to the podcast, now join the Facebook group.
Right.
I could definitely see that. Contrary Conversations community, you get into that Facebook group. Oh, there are these discussions that are happening, and then the next level is like going and checking out the podcast. And it's fun to watch how these things have changed. Like, if you go back to the early days of my podcast, you hear, like, me heavily promoting my MySpace, right? And heavily promoting all this. And it's fun to, like, be in that for the long game. So, like, right now, mid-2017, oh, yeah, that Facebook group is where it's at.
Right.
I didn't even – 2015 when I launched, I don't think I was – I've actually had a Facebook group since like 2008 or 2007 or something. But I went in about a year ago and dusted it off. And I actually was still directing people to my MySpace page in that Facebook group. That shows you like how old it had been. So that, yeah, in terms of community, that has worked great. Back in the day, I had forums on my site and that sort of thing. And then I became like a spam monitor. You know, my life just became like trying to deal with forum spam. And so, yeah, if anybody's starting anything, you know, especially like a podcast, man, that's a great way to develop and foster some community.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Yeah. So on your, in addition to that, are there courses or like coaching programs that you're teaching based off of your podcast, or how else are you using your podcast to, you know, to build up some revenue?
Right. That's the big question that people have with something like that is like, how do you have a pod? Like, what do you do? How does that work? And I think the answer, my answer is very similar to what a lot of other people online do. Like I put out my first course a couple months ago about building your own thing online. I'm working on my next course, which will be base focused and putting those out. So courses are an element. I have enough of a listenership and my audience is niche enough that I have advertising and I have some great advertisers and there's a lot of interest in that. So advertising is if someone's trying to start their own thing, I think the dream back in the mid 2000s was I'm going to write on my blog, I'm going to do my podcast and the advertisers will come and I will make my living from these ads and it'll be great. And while that's true for like a tiny percentage of people, that's hard going. It's probably not going to happen the way you think. And even if it does, there is an easier path, which is to the multiple income streams, right? So so for me, advertising is an income stream, but then also I teach base lessons. I do coachings and consulting. So that has come out. That's a piece of what I do for sure. Events, I go and I either speak at events or I kind of manage these different events. I'm going down to Texas to do a live podcast next week and that'll be live streamed on YouTube and that sort of thing. So people bring me in for that sort of thing. I do some consulting for some companies in the music world and I've written a couple of books and those have actually done pretty well. And then what else do I, what's another piece of the puzzle? Those are some of my main pieces. And so I look every month and I see like these seven or eight revenue streams coming in. And I think that's a very common way that someone who does a podcast does it. And so I think a good takeaway for listeners is the podcast for me is a platform. It's not my business. My business is the coaching and the consulting and the events and the revenue from the writings and that sort of thing and the advertising, you know, but the podcast is really my platform.
Okay. That's good to know.
Yeah.
So with everything that you're doing and clearly you are a very busy guy, how do you approach your work-life balance and your schedule? Like, do you have a routine that you do every single day? Are there certain apps or time, you know, commitment things that you do? How do you manage that?
Yeah, and I'll rewind super super quickly and tell you about the horrible work life balance I had back in 2005 2006. Right, so like I was starting this stuff up and it was like wake up at 4 a.m. furiously write blog posts. I used to put out 3 blog posts a day, and I did that for several years. So I have something like 4,000 blog posts I put out. You know, but most of them were this like intense busy period. I went back to school. So then I had classes and then I went and played gigs and taught students. And then it'd be like 11:30 PM. And I'm like having some argument in my comments on my blog with some like prickly bass player. And so I had no, and my wife was like, what are you doing? And so, come and I went back and I went into the world of public ed, and I was just like, I can't deal with this blog and podcast stuff and do this job. So it went super quiet for the years I was doing that. Mm-hmm. When I came back to it, I knew what work-life balance – I knew what bad work-life balance was. And so I have very consciously adopted kind of like a regular person work schedule, but I'm doing my own thing during those hours. So
okay.
And it's easy for me because my wife is a radiologist. She goes off to work, and radiologists have pretty regular hours. So I'm on the clock when she's gone, and when she mm-hmm. comes home, I'm done with all this sort of stuff. So a couple of like specific things I do, and it's different for everybody, but I think it's interesting to hear how people like manage their time. I love hearing that. So I wake up every day and I make a French press coffee thing, and I drink it, and I look at the clock and I think about what I would have been doing a couple years ago, mm-hmm. and which would have been sitting in Chicago traffic on the way to my day job. And I smile and I feel gratitude for that life. And I think that's like a cheesy thing to think about, but it's a great way to start off the day. Mm-hmm. And then for me, I work for a couple hours, and I'm a big fan of the Pomodoro technique. I have okay. my Pomodoro timer going, and I try to get like 4 Pomodoros, which if people aren't familiar with that, that's a system where you work for an interval and then you get up and do something different for an interval. And for me, it's 25 minutes on, 5 minutes off. And I okay. find running that timer, it's I like that system because it's simple. It's not like some complex, like, you know, like sub bullet point thing that I have to go through every day. It's just like I turn on this timer and then it goes ding ding. And then I get up and I do something different. I stretch, I do some jumping jacks, I move around. Mm-hmm. And just having that timer going, it lends a little bit of urgency to whatever I'm doing rather than just sort of sitting there. And especially with creative work or big projects, I think it's easy to kind of get lost in your projects and not actually get things done. So I do that for a couple hours. Then about 10 a.m., I go out for a run, and I find that running for me is like a great time to synthesize ideas. Okay. And as I get into my run, or like especially as I'm finishing up, and I'm fortunate enough to live in San Francisco, so I like it's nice weather. I know in Boston and back when I was in Chicago, the last thing I wanted to do in like February was like go for a run.
Right.
It was not like that, but here it's beautiful and I'm looking at Marin and I'm looking at the Golden Gate Bridge, and it's a very sort of inspiring, easy, way to sort of, you know, have a nice state change. And for me, mm-hmm. I get so many great ideas, or I'm like, that's the next step I need to do. I get that at like the end of that run. So I intentionally do that, come back, eat a little breakfast or like a late breakfast, early lunch, and then work a little bit more on creative work. And mm-hmm. notice, people listening, I haven't mentioned email at once at this point. And I'm a big fan of like the later I can delay email in the day.
Yeah.
The less time I spend in my email. Like I do respond to emails, I get back to people within a day, but I try to not start my day off with that because then it just becomes like that. It's like a very scattered way for me to start.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm the same way with that too. I try really hard not to just wake up in the morning and check my emails because you're right. When I do that, I feel like I'm always, especially if there are emails that I get that I don't like.
Yes.
Then it's like for the rest of the day, I'm either really angry about that, or it's like my focus then has to switch over to that. So I think that's great.
Oh, I hear you 100%. I mean, that's one of those things like, and some of the people I follow, like in the tech world, the entrepreneurial world, that's like a very common thread is like getting a large block of time for your creative projects. And for me, that mm-hmm. could be something as mundane as just editing my podcast. But as I'm editing, I'm thinking about what the guest is talking about and I'm coming up with some takeaways. Or yeah. It could be I'm working on this really big project having to do with universities and double base programs in the U.S., I love these big nerdy projects. Like, I can't wait to open up my spreadsheet and work on that. And mm-hmm. and it's creative work and it's complex and it doesn't have easy answers, and just not having any distractions for those hours. I really get a lot done. And then right around noon, that's when I flip into like employee mode and mm-hmm. and I answer my emails and I bang through my to-dos and I get on Facebook and promote whatever I'm promoting, and I do more of the business kind of tasks in the afternoon. And if my wife's working late, maybe I'll do a little creative work later, but I don't hold myself to that. I find that if I work too much today that robs me of my creativity for tomorrow. And I never used to think that. I used to think I'll just work like crazy, work. And then I realized the quality of what I'm doing suffers if I don't give myself a little bit of a restriction. So I really try to like be very focused, but give myself time to read and recharge and listen to podcasts and get outside. And if I look at a week where I do that and I'm good about that, or a week mm-hmm. where I just like go nuts and work like crazy, I think what I produce is more interesting and fresher and creative when I do put some time limits on myself.
Okay, that makes sense. When you have so transitioned from parts of your career, there have probably been times when you felt apprehensive or fearful. How do you approach fear with either new projects or even when you work with other people? How do you teach them or help them approach fear and get over fear?
Yeah, fear is tough, and fear shuts things down. Like fear and anxiety. Anxiety is especially anxiety, fear, you know, they're definitely related. The definition of anxiety I like is like focusing. I think anxiety is focusing on the future. Depression mm-hmm. is focusing on the past. I think that's what I've heard in the past, and I like that, right?
Right.
So like, what's the downside to whatever you're thinking about or whatever you're struggling? And I think that the downside is much less than people think. It's tough. It's tough. It's something I've struggled with a lot. I think a lot of why I went into that education world was mm-hmm. fear of this. Like, I'm creating this thing. Because back in, like, I had, you know, this crazy no work-life balance period where I was also, like, things were taking off. What was happening was I was starting a business, and I didn't realize I was doing it. I was getting I was doing consultations. I was doing talks. I was getting hired to manage other people's podcasts. I was mm-hmm. getting at, you know, all that sort of stuff was happening. And I think that I was worried about the unpredictability of that kind of work. And the idea of just having a regular paycheck really appealed to me. So I had a period of my life where I did have that, kind of like sandwiched in between two periods where it was more self-directed. And I think that worrying, a lot of fear that people have, at least that I've spoken with in kind of this world that I live in, it's just the fear of the unknown, the unpredictability of like where their next paycheck is coming from or where their next project is coming from. Mm-hmm. So trying to, for me personally, or talking to other people, trying to get people to focus on what they can control, which you can actually control the predictability of like what I'm talking about with your schedule. Like I can't control if I'm going to get like this event I have in Texas, or I can't control this or that, but what can I control? Well, I can control creating something of value. I can control, like, I'm fortunate enough that I have, you know, pretty big listenership for my podcast. So I get a lot of emails of people like, thank you so much. I live in Australia. I listen to your podcast every day. I've learned so much. And listening to what they say. And then, you know, in my email sequence, the typical question, what are you struggling with? A lot of people answer that. And so mm-hmm. like really like internalizing and listening and shaping kind of what I do, whether on the podcast or in writing or courses or whatever, I can control like how I listen to what people say and that sort of thing. So focusing on what you can control is huge. And then just, being realistic about both about, you know, the time it takes to create something, the impact that it might have, you know, a specific time frame, but also like, what's the downside of doing this? I think in mm-hmm. most cases, when I talk to people, the worst downside is you've invested some time. And if you look at any project you're doing as a self-improvement project, then you're never wasting your time. And I think that's a great way. I think that's something I pulled from Tim Ferriss. I'm sure I stole that from Tim Ferriss, actually. Now that I think about it, but like he talked about that with his podcast, which is fabulously popular, but he committed to doing 6 episodes as a self-improvement project, mm-hmm. getting to ask better questions, become better at public speaking and that sort of thing. And that's, I think that's such a healthy way to look at any project you do. Like think of it selfishly. What am I? And I think of that with my podcast. Like I'm working on being more outgoing, connecting mm-hmm. with people that I might not connect with otherwise, working on having better flow in my conversation. I'm much better. I still say but boy, do I say a lot less of that than I used to, right? Because if you edit a podcast and you have to listen to yourself say, you quickly work hard in your own speaking and like trying to eliminate some of those verbal tics mm-hmm. and just presenting ideas clearly. So I think any project, if you can look at it as a self-improvement project, that's a very useful way to reframe or to frame things.
Mm-hmm. With what you're working on now, and you know, with the coaching part, and then also you mentioned that you were working with some universities on double bass programs. How do you encourage new musicians to think about their careers and the possibilities? Because I know this is not anything new, where you know classical music has had, especially people going into it, have having problems with that, you know, that yes. one job. So how do you approach that and encourage new musicians to think about their careers as a whole?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great, and obviously that's something you're thinking about a lot in your role, you know, and I think that's such a crucial thing to think about. The first thing I do, anytime anybody asks that, is to direct people to my great friend, Andrew Hitz, who has a wonderful podcast called The Entrepreneurial Musician. And if folks haven't listened to that, highly recommend checking out that podcast. And it dives into the world of music and those topics just so well, so eloquently. That's one of my, when it comes out of my feed, I instantly press play, you know, like one of those shows. Something that he has mentioned and other people have mentioned and I just love is two of the most conservative institutions here in the United States are classical music and higher mm-hmm. education. So this is like the unholy nexus of non-progressive thinking. Like I had a job at Northwestern in the music library back when I was in college, and I would go and pull old Chicago Symphony programs, and I would open up something from like 1951, and it looked exactly like a program from 2001. In fact, it was more progressive a lot of time because they would have more contemporary music of the time, you know. Right. And then if you look also, and this is something a recent podcast guest brought up, but if you look at the curriculum in most still music schools, and you mm-hmm. look at that and look at 1950s, it's almost identical. And then if you look at any other subject, like computer science, well, that didn't exist, right?
Right.
And or just like how so many other areas, especially vocational areas, have changed. It's just remarkable. So I think that's something worth thinking about. And you know, if you're thinking of, you know, literature, English, or whatever, some other fields, maybe they haven't changed that much either. But I think a lot of people that going into music, they're thinking of it as a vocational career pursuit and not a liberal arts career pursuit. And I think that's where people get tied up. Like, are we a vocational pursuit? I would argue that we are, because if we look at some of the schools that don't offer vocational pursuits, like UC mm-hmm. Berkeley or Stanford or Harvard or whatever, they don't have music performance. That's like plumbing or whatever, right? It's like, or engineering, you know, like it's not, that's not something that like fits into that frame. So yeah, it's hard, and it's hard for faculty to make that switch, because the typical person on university career trajectory, they got 3 degrees in their pocket, right? They got their bachelor's, mm-hmm. their master's, their PhD. They're not out being entrepreneurs. They might understand the need for that, and hopefully have the thought to bring people in that world and do mm-hmm. that, but they're not living in that world. And then the people that are living in that world, they're running around. The number of people that are running around with PhDs or DMAs and are entrepreneurs is really small.
Right. Right.
So it's a big problem. And some schools are really progressive in thinking about that. New England Conservatory is a great example. They're doing wonderful things. Curtis has done great things. And it's funny because these are some of the places that have the most banging, amazing performance schools, and they are seeing the need, right? Other places, actually, that where I'm going, University of Texas, several of the schools, UT Rio Grande Valley is where I'm going, way down in South Texas. They are doing amazing things. They've merged with another university, and they had a chance to totally rethink their entire music curriculum. It was just one of those fortuitous moments. And they have really reoriented what they're doing toward creating people with a little bit more of an entrepreneurial mindset.
Sure.
One quick tangent that I thought could be interesting, and I love your thoughts, is freelancer versus entrepreneur. I really think that those are two different things. And I think a lot of musicians or artists or web designers or illustrators, that sort of thing, end up going down a freelance path. But I think that I firmly think that's different than an entrepreneurial path. I don't know what do you have any thoughts on that sort of? Have you
on the freelancer versus entrepreneur? So I definitely believe those are two separate distinct paths.
Yeah.
And I would classify more artists and musicians who are doing like more of like a job to job or gig to gig type of thing as a freelancer versus an entrepreneur.
Yes.
Although I feel like for entrepreneur it's one of those buzzwords now that everybody is using.
Yeah.
Themselves.
I know it's a word that bugs me. That's why I try to I resisted labeling myself like that at the beginning because it really you're one of those guys like crushing it like with a picture of me in San Francisco like in my running clothes, which is like exactly what I do. So I am one of those people like sadly, but I I think that what I see some music schools doing is like almost reframing freelance work as entrepreneurship. But I really think it's a different set of skills and a different mentality and more of a approaching things with looking at them in a way of being of service of like developing something and understanding some of those skills of like turning something into a business and scaling it out and looking for new opportunities that might not be there. I think that's really different than what I was definitely not an entrepreneur in my first freelance career. I was waiting for the phone to ring. I was waiting for those students to call me. I was waiting for permission for all of these sort of things. I think to me, I know you think a lot about that and teach along those lines. So I just love, I wanted to hear your thoughts on that. That's very cool.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And definitely in my own training as a professional set and costume designer, it was very much the same thing. It was more of a, like the freelancer where, we were just going, we were taught just to go from like one job to another job.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't actually tell you how to do that. That was one of my biggest criticisms.
Yeah.
So I went to the Yale School of Drama. Never once did we talk about actually how to get a job as a freelance set or costume designer. It was like, oh, don't worry, they're just going to come to you like some kind of magical thing. Or, because you've met, and that does happen in a lot of people's careers where they met, like there's a lot of directors who work with the same designers. And then once that director gets a job, they bring the entire team with them and keep going up and up and up from there. And that does happen rather infrequently nowadays, but that's one way to do it. Yeah. But definitely that. So I would definitely not classify anything I learned as entrepreneurial. But I do believe that a lot of the skills I learned in those skills helped me become an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of like what we call the soft skills these days of selling, networking, just like promoting yourself and politicking, I guess, and the fact that you're getting other people involved in your ideas. All of those I learned in my, my early painting classes, some of my music classes, my design classes, which are now, when I launched my company and I did a bunch of other things, really helped me along once I realized that these are all skills I learned a while ago, so I shouldn't really be freaked out about them.
Oh, I love hearing you describe that. I totally identify with that. And like, one thing that I like to point out to people when I talk about that is like a lot of people, they go into music because of that creative urge, right? But if you look at like a lot of traditional, those that remain, like whether it's orchestra or academia or the freelance work I'm talking about, it's not exactly creative work. Like if you're like my instrument, the double bass, you're going and if you're being creative on your part in the symphony, that's a bad thing, right?
Right.
So I think that initial urge that propelled people to maybe get into that, I think that the entrepreneurship really scratches that itch. Like I feel like I love sitting down and thinking about what direction do I want to go next? What should I do that? Or how I feel like that brings all those initial reasons why I went into music in the first place. I feel like I'm reconnecting with that, with what I'm doing now. And when I see people, whether in their college or whatever, or they decide to kind of strike out on their own in a bit, and whether it's some combination of, these things are flexible. It doesn't have to be A or B. And but when they start creating their own thing, whether that's even like starting a chamber music series or starting to write something or starting to just do something that's you know, if we want to go back into buzzwords, like creating value for other people, you know, that it's like it rekindles something in them. Mm-hmm. They might be like a freelancer. They're like in their mid 30s or late 30s. I can think of some people this is exactly happening. And all of a sudden they're like all jazzed up about music again. And I really think it's because they found some way to exercise that creative, those creative impulses. And I just think it's a beautiful thing. I look at when I was not just a freelancer, but yeah, you know, basically a freelancer. I even remember thinking there was this chamber music series I'd play up in Door County, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And the person that started this also started another orchestra in Chicago called the Chicago Philharmonic. And he's somebody who's a great kind of mix of, he was a principal bassoon of the Lyric Opera. He taught at Northern Illinois, very traditional careers, right? But then he also started these two things that are like, you know, million-plus-dollar budget they've got to stand. He has created all this value, and he, as a result, hires all these musicians every year. He's added so much to the Illinois and Wisconsin music scene, mm-hmm. and I just – he's somebody that I thought of time and time again as somebody that is a great model of the more people – and there's a Heather Miller Larden, a bass player out in Philadelphia, has done the same thing in the early music world, and Joe Conyers in Philadelphia has created this – Project 440, and he's bringing music into the Philly public schools in this really interesting way, and mm-hmm. and all those people have university jobs and or orchestra jobs, but they're so passionate about those side projects, right? So whether you're doing it full time like what I'm doing, or you have gone down one of those career paths, I think that really connects with people's why in a powerful way.
It does, and I think it's amazing. I spent a lot of time seeking out people like that and chatting with them. And I love hearing those stories and listening to people who are like, I didn't ask for permission. I just decided that I was going to start this because this is what I'm really passionate about. And then they're creating their own path. So I think that's actually like in the freelancer versus entrepreneur, it's that person who's like, this is my passion, but I'm going to now start this organization or this company or theater or company or whatever it is. And that then will then, you know, create opportunities for other people along with myself. And I think that's like the freelancer versus the entrepreneur. That's like a huge distinction right there of creating something bigger than yourself on that. That's great.
Yeah.
What would you say is the best advice you've ever received?
The best advice I've ever received is probably, and I thought about this because I know you asked this, is don't get help. Don't, and that sounds weird, Jason, you need help, but like, don't be afraid to find other people and get them involved in your project. And I've done that. It took me far too long to do that, but I have a small team helping me now, you know, just part time, but it has unlocked so many. There were so many things that I was just sitting on and perseverating about because it was just me, the whole like solopreneur, just kind of like whether like when we were doing these website redesigns, logo redesigns, all this stuff I've known I've needed to do, redesigning mm-hmm. our app. And it's just like, okay, I have my list of things that I want to work on and that I need to work on. And I it was not my skill set. and even like getting a second set of ears, a second set of thoughts and ideas to bounce ideas for where you're going off of, that's been so helpful. So it can be like what I did is like starting to build a team, and then mm-hmm. also like it was so helpful for me like starting to get involved in masterminds, people who are kind of doing what I'm doing, and I've been in several masterminds. I got my own mastermind, and that has been so helpful. And it's one of those things, like my Chicago friends probably is like, of course he has a mastermind. Now he's living in San Francisco. He's like doing all that, you know, but it's a very like, of course, you know, and meditation and going for, and, but those things are so helpful in terms of, just getting some direction, because when you're doing, mm-hmm. when you're creating your own project, you spend a lot of time in your own head. What am I doing? What is this? Is this a good idea? Is this a bad idea? And just having a few people to bounce ideas off of, and to have them bounce their ideas off of you. And one more thing that's valuable with that, having some accountability that, mm-hmm. that like, oh no, my mastermind's coming up. I didn't do that thing I was you know, complaining about never doing. And I've there are many things, like even from like starting my LLC finally a couple of years back, I was like, never did. I knew I needed to. It's like, oh no, my mastermind's coming up. I can't walk in there with my tail between my legs. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I went in and it took me a couple hours and I started it and all was good. Right. So I think getting help. Get help in whatever you're doing. Don't be afraid to enlist other people. And I think that's true. You know, when I interview all these people who've won auditions, that's the thing I do. That's the key thing that pretty much everybody has said in their audition journey. It's like, when did things start to click for you? They're like, when I started to play for other people and get their opinions. And I think that's true for me on my current path as well.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Jason, thank you so much for chatting with me today. I really appreciate it. If the listeners would like to see more about what you're working on, what is the best way they can do that?
Even if you don't care about bass at all, which probably most of you don't, but go to ContrabassConversations.com. That's the place to go. That has links to my blog, which has writings on – you can find all my crazy gig stories, my car exploding story and others there. I'm pretty active on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all that. So you can follow me wherever you like to hang out, and I'd love to connect. And I'm very accessible. I respond to all my emails. Even – it won't be before 10 a.m. like you heard from this interview, but – feel free to reach out to me and all that info, ContrabassConversations.com. You can get in touch.
Okay, perfect. I will put all those in the show notes so they can just click through and find you easily.
Sweet.
Great. Well, again, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks a ton.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Advance Your Art Podcast. If you like this episode, please go into iTunes and give us a 5-star rating. And while you're there, hit the subscribe button so that every single time I release a new episode, it will go directly to you without even thinking about it. If you're interested in hearing older episodes, please go to advanceyourart.com where you can find the catalog of everything I've done so far, as well as contact information and projects I'm working on. Thank you again, and have a great day.